God is a crutch. He's a crutch for the psychologically weak. God is an unnecessary hypothesis for those with an incoherent need to believe. God is a cosmic father figure for those with deep existential angst as to their own identity and significance. Well, perhaps you've heard or mouthed or contemplated these kind of ideas, and I, for one, don't want to diss them out of hand. The idea would have little force if it was a complete kind of bogey argument. I think trusting in God does make many people feel more content, more significant, if not actually on measurable criteria, even more successful in life. Which is perhaps why, on the other hand, many others take pride in kind of being open-minded enough to say, well, whatever works for you, whatever works for you. And within that phrase, whatever works for you, of course, is usually the implied prior statement, the unspoken word, well, God can't work for me, but whatever works for you. You probably won't be shocked to hear, given that you're at a Christian meeting, that I question some basic premises contained within both of these responses to Christianity. God is true and real and not merely a soothing make-believe. And because he's truly God, they're not just something that works for a few, but the God of all. Now, we don't unfortunately have the time to explore the reality and existence and godness of God question tonight. But by all means, if you want to, let's do explore. Let's talk. You could, you know, write on your feedback form, date with Paul, talk about God. Or if you don't like talking to dinosaurs, you know, date with Joel. or just come to our Think Week discussions, discussion groups next week. That would also be a good thing to do. But there is another premise within these two responses to Christianity that I do resonate with, I do share, I do agree with. It's actually really profoundly important to our topic today about freedom. And it's the assumption that it's the duty of people, the duty of people, to live for the most glory. Now, not many people would put it that way, so let me explain what I mean. The way to freedom is to find and to live for that which is the most real, the most substantial, the most good, the most life-giving. Now, the objectivists, those, you know, who claim there is no God, do well, you see, to respond to Christians by asking them to give up their psychological crutches. Because there is no freedom in basing your life believing in someone who doesn't exist, on something that is not true. That's not living for the most glory, is it? It's just silly. On the other hand, the others, the kind of the more postmodern subjectivists, we might call them, those who think that God would be a great idea if only they could believe somehow, they also do well to, in their response to Christians, with their semi-encouragement, you know, whatever works for you, because ideas themselves are sometimes some of the most substantial things that we can pursue, that we can live for. I'll give you an example. Most of us pursue the idea of democracy. It's always an ideal. There's no true democracy that's practiced, and yet many of us would be prepared to even fight for that ideal. Maybe even sacrifice our life to protect, because it's deeply good. We think it's substantial, it's life-giving. It's the way to freedom to pursue that. People should live for the most glory. They should find and live for that which is the most real, the most substantial, the most good, the most life-giving, because that's the way humans find freedom. And this is the perspective of the Bible. And we see it clearly today in Exodus 32 to 34. We see it in three ways. Firstly, negatively, through Israel in their response to God. Then positively, through Moses, the aftermath. And preeminently then, in God, chapter 34, which we just read. Let me just bring you up to speed a little bit on the story in case you've forgotten or unfamiliar. See, God has used Moses to rescue the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, the world superpower at the time. The slavery was certainly real and substantial, but it was not good or life-giving. And so God rescued them miraculously, showing that he was utterly good. He was faithful to his promises. He was someone who was interested in giving them life. And of course, also showing that he was even more real and more substantial than all the power of the Pharaoh and Egypt. In short, God was who Israel should truly pursue, live for, find freedom in, live for the most glory. Living for the most glory was to live for him now. You see, they had been serving Egypt, but it was actually clear, totally clear, that serving God was now the way to freedom. And so, I guess it was almost expected, just so right, but nevertheless, even so, God kind of lays out what it's going to mean. He's just so utterly good, he kind of lays it all out, what it means to live for him. You know, no, have no other gods besides him. Worship only him. When you worship him, don't use images of him, because idols, they can't represent God. Any idol ends up being a parody of God. And so on and so on. And then the inevitable crunch moment comes. Exodus 24, verse 7. Moses, it says, took all these words from God, made it in a book of a covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey. We will obey." And you kind of think, of course. That's just so obvious, isn't it? So right. You'd be crazy not to. I mean, after all that they'd experienced, God's power, his goodness, the way he'd given their life back. And so they willingly covenant with God, it's called. They kind of agree to a pact to worship only God and obey him. They have this big ritual where they sprinkle blood on their head, saying, "Blood be on my head if I go back on this agreement." And that's where we kind of pick up the story tonight. Exodus 32. Whew, I really am a dinosaur, aren't I? Okay. "When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said, 'Come, make us gods that will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him.' Aaron answered them, 'Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me.' So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, 'These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.' When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, 'Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord.' So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry." This is an attempt to worship God, Yahweh, by casting an image of him in common perception of deity at the time, a calf. And in fact, cows still are associated with deity in many cultures today. Did you hear what Aaron says, though? "Let's hold a festival to, to the Lord, capital L-O-R-D. That's the English way of saying Yahweh, God's name. They look at this calf and they said, behold our gods who brought us up out of Egypt. But the problem is that we know that this is not the way to freedom, is it? This is not seeking the most glory. When you represent God in an image, you start to serve it instead of God. Even if you think it's reminding you of God. You also, by the way, totally demean God. God is nothing like a stupid cow. One of the Ten Commandments that Lachlan took us through last week, Exodus 20 verse 4, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything, in heaven above or on the earth beneath or the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. This festival is a direct transgression of that second commandment. But even deeper, of course, it's a denial of Yahweh himself. It's a repudiation of his character. Therefore, it's lack of faithfulness to him. Idols misrepresent God. They communicate lies about what he is like. Cows often walk in their own shit. Cows often struggle to shake the flies away from their ears and eyes. And to set one up, that's to raise the finger against God. So what all this amounts to is a massive fall. In technical language, apostasy. Apostasy against God is akin to what adultery is against a spouse. It's a fundamental breach of relationship, an attack against them in contempt. And remember, it's only been a few days since they said, blood be upon our head if we don't worship God. Literally days before. Yes, Lord, we will do everything you say. So this is the lowest degradation, isn't it? Because it's the highest betrayal. It's like sleeping with the bellboy in the honeymoon suite on your wedding night while your new husband is down at reception finalizing check-in and moving the car to appropriate parking. Yeah, got 10 minutes. Let's do it. Or to be fair to both genders present, it's like taking the maid into the closet for a quickie while your new bride is kind of pampering herself in the bathroom, getting yourself ready to come out and consummate the marriage. That's the depth of unfaithfulness that is displayed here. But of course, against God. The God who has just redeemed them from slavery in Egypt, who has made them into his own people. He's given them a special commission in the world to be his treasured possession. And that, of course, means living out in revealing his will. This is the negative, isn't it? This is not living for the most glory, but degrading themselves. Because what you imitate is what you become like. Well, then the Lord said to Moses, go down, because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and said, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses. "They are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I'll make you into a great nation." In other words, all hell is about to break loose. And rightly so. Rightly so. God's not even talking like Israel, his people anymore. They're yours, Moses. You brought them up out of Egypt, not me. God wants nothing to do with them. So that's point one, the fall. Israel has come from precious possession to potential destruction, from living for glory to degrading themselves. Point two, the aftermath. The next two chapters, basically, is long and complex. And that kind of fits the situation, doesn't it? Because restoration from this point is going to be pretty hairy. You all know, some things are impossible to undo. The consequences of some decisions are just, it's steep and torturous. And so, in these aftermath, the next two chapters, there's this confusing and painful process of marriage counseling. Okay, it's intense and it's frantic, as you'd expect it to be in such a time of crisis. But in the heart of it all, in the confusion, is Moses. Moses is playing the part of the marriage counselor, as it were. Moses is the man who truly does know what it means to live for the most glory, because he fights tooth and nail for the best outcome, for the good, for the life-giving situation, both for God and for Israel. See, initially, Moses doesn't even dare go down the mountain as God told him, until he first gets assurance from God that he's not going to destroy them. He intercedes with God and says, in effect, "Hey, you might want to consume them, but don't do that, because what will Egypt think? Wouldn't your name be tarnished? The Egyptians, who know it wasn't some idol, some calf who brought them up, they'll think that you actually brought them out here to kill them. What about your promises that you made? Are you going to be faithful to them, God? You made promises to Abraham to multiply his descendants. You don't want to have to start again with me and my kids, do you?" See, Moses is very direct with God, basically telling God to get the most glory for himself out of this bad situation, to preserve life, to preserve his honor and his reputation. And so God gives him an assurance. Okay, I won't destroy them, not immediately. And once he's got this assurance, then Moses does actually do as God said, and he leaves. He goes down the mountain. Only once he's got this concession, though. And he leaves his intercession with God and hot-tails it down the mountain to deal now with the other party, the offending party, to deal with the Israelites. And kind of what happens in these next two chapters is, we won't have time to read it all, is Moses keeps going back between the two, like this marriage counselor. He goes to the adulterer Israel and he castigates them. He rebukes them, he regales them. And then he goes back to the faithful one, to God, and implores and pleads and beseeches. All the time trying to work towards the best outcome for a non-dissolution of this relationship between God and his people Israel. So for example, when he comes down the mountain, he throws down the two stone tablets and smashes them in front of the whole festival to the Lord that's going on. Very vivid picture of what they've done to God. He calls those who are loyal to Yahweh to come to him and to strike down those who won't stop worshipping the calf. The sons of Levi, it says, kill 3,000 people, probably those most responsible for holding the festival. Then, and only then, when the festival, also known as the adultery, is stopped by force, then, okay, once it's stopped, now he turns back to God, goes back up the mountain, and he pleads for Israel again, intervenes on their behalf, each time calling on the character of God. And there's this kind of this movement in God's disposition. At first God says, okay, all right, I won't destroy them now, but, yep, they're going to cop it sometime. Sometime they'll have to be punished. And then bit of discourse. Okay, so he moves. All right, so I will send the Israelites up to Palestine alive, but I won't go. I'll let them to themselves. And a bit of discourse. And then, so finally he says, okay. I'll send the Israelites up to Palestine, but Moses, I'm only going to be with you. I'm not going to be with all of Israel. I'm just going to be with you. And it's at this point, that Moses knows he's kind of on a winner. Because what does Moses do? Oh, you're going to be with me, God. Excellent. You know who I'm with? I'm with Israel. So you have to be with Israel. Because you said you'll be with me. It's remarkable. So if you got your Bible there, we pick it up at 33:14. The Lord replied, "My presence will go with you, Moses, and I will give you rest." Moses said to God, "If your presence does not go with us," plural, "do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth?" What an amazing man Moses has been in all this. Living for true glory, you see. All the time, utterly committed to God, to his character. What will be best for God? He knows that as the one in the relationship who's been besmirched, his honor is at stake. His reputation has been blackened, and yet all the time, on the very basis of God's character and honor and reputation, he pleads for the case of Israel as well. In fact, at one point in this dialogue, he even says to God, "Look, blot me out rather than Israel." Because he doesn't want God to suffer the indignity of Egypt and all the other nations laughing at God, or of having to start his purposes for winning back the world to himself through a nation just from scratch again. 33:17, the Lord said to Moses, "I will do the very thing you've asked, because I am pleased with you and I know you by name." God's pleased with Moses because Moses knows very well his place, doesn't he? Very well. He doesn't usurp Israel and say, "Yeah, okay, start again with me." No. He knows very well that it was truly the real and powerful and loving God, not him, who brought them up out of Egypt. And through all this crisis, Moses has been living for that one, for God, for God's glory. And if you don't believe me, you finally see it come out in the story. 33:18. Then Moses said, "Show me your glory. I want to see glory, God. I don't want half measures here. I don't want you to start with me again. I want to see true glory. True life-giving glory. Utter goodness to your people, God. That's what I want to see. Because I am living for the most glory, which is yours, not mine. I don't want to be made into a great nation. I want you, God. to make a great nation for yourself. Show me your glory, God, because you are the most real, the most substantial, the only true life giver, the deeply good one. So God says, the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. I'll have compassion on whom I have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I'll put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I'll remove my hand and you will see my back, but you, my face, you must not see. So there's Moses, living for the most glory. But preeminent glory is to come. It's God's. And we see it in chapter 34, which Bronwyn read, where God restores Israel, takes her back, promises to be with her, recommissions her. Moses says, I want to see your glory, but initially he just kind of hears it, actually. He doesn't get to see God, but he does get to hear God proclaim his name. And that's found in verses 6 and 7. It's on your handout. It's worth reading again. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love to the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. That is pure goodness, isn't it? That is genuine substance. And that's at the heart of the universe. That kind of being. Do you know that there hasn't been 1,000 generations yet, from Moses until now? And that's how deep and enduring God's loving faithfulness is. We get to just live maybe 2 generations, 80 years, if we're lucky. But God is faithful to us for 1,000 generations. In our short lifetime, we might fail God countless times. But if we could live 1,000 generations long, God would still be faithful to us because of his steadfast love and mercy. He would not turn away from us in our failures. And yet, being utterly good, he does this in a way that doesn't turn a blind eye to our sin. It says he will not let human guilt remain unpunished. And in the fuller kind of revelation of God, we know that the way that he does that is to bear the pain and the cost of sin himself. And of course, the gruesome events of Easter is how he did it, when he did it for all people in all time. Easter, of course, was when an even better mediator than Moses interceded for us, God's own Son. So when Moses hears God's glory, verse 8, he quickly bowed his head towards the earth and worshipped, and he said, if now I found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and sin, and take us for your inheritance. And now Moses gets to see God's glory. He kind of hears it in God's name, and now he sees it. How does he see it? God making the covenant again with them. Verse 10, God said, "Behold, I'm making a covenant." It's a totally fresh start. God is kind of welcoming back his apostate people. It's beginning again, but of course with the same people. Okay, new start, guys. Let's go. And as you read on, you see that the covenant is the same as the previous one. He has a bit of a speech here, which rightly kind of emphasizes how not to do false worship. But at the end of the chapter, God gives Moses a replacement copy of exactly the same 10 words that we looked at last week. So there you have, living for the most glory. Not to degrade yourself by giving yourself to something less worthy than you truly belong to. No, no, no. You belong to the glory of God. Living for him. Because he is faithful and merciful to the thousandth generation. There is freedom in God alone. Pursue it.